Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest this week is George Saunders, who you may know from such hits as the Booker Prize-winning novel Lincoln in the Bardo, or his legendary short story collection, 10th of December. You'll be pleased to learn that the hits keep coming. His latest work of nonfiction ends up being a gorgeous sort of symposium. It's called A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a master class on writing, reading, and life. In addition to being an all-around literary superstar, Saunders has taught creative writing at Syracuse University for the past 20 years. And one of the courses he teaches routinely is on the 19th century Russian short story in translation. That course, distilled, is this book. And the Russian masters he brings on to help lead the discussion are Chekhov, Tolstoy, Turgenev, and my new favorite, because he's entirely off the wall, Nikolai Gogol. Here's some of what our reviewer had to say about A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. Quote, "As Saunders shows throughout this thrilling literary lesson, the answer has little to do with conventional notions of theme and plot. It's more about energy, efficiency, intentionality, and other details of internal dynamics. Saunders explains how what might seem like flaws often work in the story's favor, and how we love some stories even more because of, rather than in spite of, those flaws," end quote. And I encourage you to read the full review on our website, kirkus.com, because it's a great review. Did I mention it's a star? It's a star. The following conversation with George Saunders was recorded last Wednesday, January 6th, and it's what I'd call a wild one, for very many reasons, and definitely one of my all-time favorites. So without further ado, let's talk with George Saunders, author of A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. Welcome, George, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Thank you for giving me the gift of Gogol. That's my guy. That's my guy now. That's my new guy.
Yeah.
Love at first loaf.
I'll tell you, he is the guy for 2020, and I hope not for 2021, but he's the guy for sure.
Well, I'm hoping we're going to get to talk about him more later in the conversation, but here we go. Here's the book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a masterclass on writing, reading, and life. The subtitle alone indicates that you are an amiable guide. You're a generous host, attributing the teaching to the Russians. But you've been teaching in Syracuse University's MFA program for about 20 years, right?
Yes, and I'm only 23, so it's kind of weird, but...
You're one of those.
Yeah, no, since 1997.
And this is like a class. It's so hard to get into this program. Like what, 600 people apply and you only admit three quarters of one human person, right?
We only let in their legs. It's very harsh. No, we out of 600 or 700 people we let in fiction, we let in six a year. Yeah.
Wow.
And so there's 3 years at any given time, so 18 people.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So
And then a separate program for poetry.
Separate program for poetry. Poetry is another thing I'd like us to come back to. How closely would you say the book resembles the course that you teach on the Russian shores?
I think pretty close. I mean, in the course, we do 30 or 40 stories over the course of the 3 or 4 month semester. But these are the seven stories that probably teach the best. And after 20 years, I always kind of look forward to getting to these because you know the class is going to light up and something special is going to happen. And in some ways, when you're teaching students at that level, you're really kind of just leading the horse to the water. They're so smart and they're so primed by their own artistic journeys that they really do teach themselves. You just say, okay, let's look at this passage of Tolstoy. Let me ask you this. And then off they go. With the essays, you actually had to you had to go beyond that and specify what you meant. So in some ways, it's probably a more precise teaching. What's missing, of course, is that essential element where, you know, if you're in my program, I've come to know you a little bit, you know, as a writer, as a person. We've talked about your issues, your obstructions, your gifts and all that. And so there's a kind of a beautiful way in which you can kind of tailor the teaching of a story to the group. Mm. And you can look around and you can see, oh, that person there who's been struggling with endings her whole time here is now lighting up because we're talking about endings in a certain way. You know, so there's an element of the personal that, you know, of course you can't really do in a book.
Mm. So are you still teaching the Russian class?
You know, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I probably am not going to. I've got a reduced load, and all I teach now is in the fall, I teach our 6-person fiction workshop to the graduating class. So, and that's just where we work on their stories. So I'll probably teach isolated stories from it, but the world where I would, you know, come in and teach 20 or 25 people, the class probably is not in effect anymore, sadly for me. So I kind of realized that a couple of years ago, and I was like, wow, so every year that passes, I'm going to be a little less sharp on this stuff. And I had this folder, this kind of red, of course, folder that I had accrued over the years. And I thought, yeah, you know, it'd be nice to kind of formalize this stuff a little bit, because it has been such a beautiful part of my life that I think for many years, I just sort of took it for granted. But, you know, as you get older and you see certain parts of your life going behind you, you can really see afresh how precious they were. So this was kind of my way of you know, trying to formalize this stuff a little more. Plus, you know, over the years, I learned so much from them. These kids are so bright. And so every year I'd add something to the folder that somebody had mentioned, and it got all kind of folded up into the greater body of knowledge.
This book is dedicated to your students. And in the introduction, you state the aim of the class is to help them acquire the technical means to become, quote, defiantly and joyfully themselves. And that's what the book does for readers. That's what it did for me as your reader. But what does that mean?
Thank you.
It's heartfelt. And man, this book made me feel. But I would not necessarily... I would not necessarily recommend reading it as I did, which is in one great big gulp yesterday. And I tried to cram...
That would be...
Yeah, I tried to cram all of your knowledge about Russian short stories into my pea brain. It was kind of like putting your ear on an oil well. And I just feel like my head is flooded.
Yeah, you got to be careful because if you've seen me, I'm very bald. And I think that could happen. You know, you put that... we were going to put that on the cover, but we forgot to put the disclaimer.
So let's...
You had a question, but I can't remember what it was now.
That phrase, defiantly and joyfully themselves. Could you expand on that, please?
Yeah. So these students that we get are so good. Yeah. They've always been the best writers in their world. And some of them are published or very close to being published already. So what you're really trying to do is say, okay, here's somebody. Let's try to help them say the thing in the voice that only they could say, you know, the unique kind of, which often sometimes means they have to reboot from what the kind of writer they think they're going to be and find this kind of new thing. So that's really deep work. It's kind of psychological. It's kind of a little Zen. It's a little judo sometimes, you know. It means also systematically encouraging them to make really high-level choices. So for example, you know, they'll write a paragraph that's really wonderful by any normal standard. Then my job is to say, okay, now, is there any waste in this thing? Is there any laziness? Is there any place where you're doing something habitual? Is there any place especially where you're kind of not telling the truth? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, sometimes this involves welcoming them to go into areas of their life that they don't even, that they try to avoid. You know, I remember one student, really wonderful writer from a really tough working class background, and he'd written this beautiful description of a bathroom in a poor household. It's sort of an offhanded thing. It was so wonderful, you know. And so in that occasion, my job was to say in front of the class, this is beautiful. So then he understands, okay, so even though I take this for granted, and maybe even I try to leave it out of my stories and make the bathrooms nicer, that's actually your superpower. You know, so it's just endlessly beautiful, rewarding work.
I really appreciate that you indicate in this book that, you know, when you do finally excavate that self, when the self you reveal is a disappointment to you, perhaps, and it is so hard to be honest about yourself to yourself sometimes, that you should just keep writing.
Right. I mean, isn't it so much like personality? You know, I remember when I was in high school in Chicago, I talked just as fast as I do now. And my brain just fires quickly and my mouth keeps up. And sometimes it's just incoherent. And so there was a time where I was like, you know, I would get more dates if I could slow down a little bit, you know? And so I tried to remake myself into a rather slow talking NPR kind of guy.
Oh, God.
And then it was even worse. That was even worse, you know? So there is a lesson in this, which is that, you know, we are born with certain attributes and deficiencies and tendencies and all that stuff. We didn't choose it, you know, it just came to us. So then the job in life, whether you're a writer or whether you're anything, is to kind of say, all right, I have to accept that which I can't jettison, and have the faith that ultimately, if you accept that stuff, it could actually even become beautiful. It could become a part of your power. You know, we all know somebody who has a strange affect or a interesting obsession. If they love it, it suddenly becomes kind of part of what they have to offer, you know? So that's sort of what we're doing at Syracuse. Sometimes it's very subtle, you know, sometimes it's just someone who's imitating another writer and we kind of urge them off that a little bit through line edits, or it can be all kinds of things. But there's kind of a, you know, I'm finding that a lot of this quote unquote writing advice has a real life corollary. And ultimately it's about kind of acceptance and maybe even character in a certain way.
Mm. I'm curious if there's been any writerly advice you've ignored and found yourself the better for.
Almost all of it. Really, you know, because most writing advice is generalized, you know, show, don't tell, whatever, you know, and that is actually antithetical to what the actual job is, because the actual job is you're a certain person on a certain day. The story is a certain story on a certain day, and you have to be there with full alertness to respond to that thing, you know. Now, that's against human nature, because we like to have a one-size-fits-all manifesto to carry around so we don't have to think too much. But art reminds us that is anti-engagement, you know, that to do that. Just like in a conversation, if you show up to the lunch with a list of things you're going to say and you don't care what the other person says in response. So I think the main thing is that writing advice is, I think of it as like, if I'm, you know, helping you with your writing, I'm going to try to really read what you've done and I'm going to line at it and I'm going to kind of get inside of it. And then I'm going to intuitively do something to inflect your progress, but it might not be right. And I'll know if it's right by how you respond to it, you know? And if you say no, you know, or you indicate, no, that didn't help me, then my job is to back off and try something else, you know? So it's very much like, it's maybe a little bit like MacGyver, you know, like he's just going to try some shit and see what works, you know? And the opposite of good teaching would be when you have one approach that you hit everybody with over the head and demand that they take it. That's not teaching. That's just showing off or dominating or something.
I mean, this I could readily apply this to podcasting, George. You know,
100%. No, I think that's you know, it's exactly right. You've got a, you know, listeners out there that you haven't met many of them, but you're talking to them as if you assume the best of them, and you know, it's really an intimate process of you know, and also ultimately, I think it's about this very human thing called projection, where, you know, you're projecting, we are right now projecting who we think your audience is.
Right.
We can't know, but we're imagining them. And that's something that the brain does really well, or at least energetically. And it's, but also it can sometimes lead us astray if we project about another group without enough information. But in writing, at least, and I'm sure in podcasting, you're trying to do a positive projection. You're imagining the audience to be as smart and curious and intelligent and well-intentioned as you are. And then they like that. People, you know, who wouldn't like that?
Hi, everybody. I love you.
We love you so much. Yeah. No, I was going to say, hi, everybody, get off your phone while you're listening to our podcast. Don't be checking your mail while we're podcasting.
That's right. You know, like to get that magic, to get that jolt, we'll need your undivided attention just for this very limited time, please.
And also a check for $50.
Please. Okay. So I'm going to pluck the word specificity out of the air. You know, it occurred somewhere in the fire hose of our conversation thus far. I want to talk about specifics. And it's one of the first things you get into in this book. The first story up is In the Cart by Chekhov. And by the way, I'm relying on you to correct any mispronunciation of my Russian, even though I know you say you're not a Russian speaker. I'm trusting you to pronounce the names of the authors.
I will never do that. I don't know. Chekhov is pronounced Tolstoy. I don't know.
So the first story we get in the cart, and one of the first things you get into in the commentary, is the importance of specificity and characterization, right? Because you're asking, like, why do we care about this specific woman? She's in a cart. Where is she going? Why do we care where she's going? You know, like, what do we know about her? And we start to get little dribs and drabs that really, yeah, you know, ensnare us. So I have to ask you, Chekhov, Turgenev, Tolstoy, Gogol, why do you care about these specific Russians?
Really, it was just that when I scanned my course list, there were about 12 stories that always taught well, and that was too many for the book. So I kept reducing it and playing around with order. And my goal really was to have stories which were teaching different things from one another, and that I could arrange in order so that I didn't repeat myself. You know, in other words, I had the idea that my essays would make a kind of overstory to the whole thing. So of that group, I really love Turgenev. I like that one story, but Chekhov,
that's
I
good.
Love, like, I wish I was him. I wish I was Chekhov. He's such a sweetheart. Tolstoy is like the really dangerous uncle I want to impress. And Gogol is just, you know, the goofy cousin who's like always telling the truth at family parties to everyone's discomfort. But I love all of them. And the specificity thing is one of the things I try to investigate in the book is, okay, let's just say you go into a hypothetical bookstore, as all we readers do, and you pick up a random book, maybe one you've heard something about, you start reading it. What happens in that first 5 seconds? And in a certain way, that's the entire universe of reading. You know, do you put the book down in disgust? Do you find yourself standing there 20 minutes later? You know, there's something that happens in your mind in response to, you know, two or three lines of prose. The whole key to the kingdom is in that. So I thought, well, can I figure out, you know, what is it about two sentences, three sentences that make us stay? You know, that's the writer's biggest question. Because if the reader doesn't stay, you got nothing. You don't have a theme or, you know, a plot or anything. So one of the things I've noticed, just again, just by watching my own mind, is that when a writer gives us something specific to imagine, it pulls us in. I don't really know why. It's just kind of a diagnosis that I've done. And then when you go into these great works with that in mind, you see it confirmed. You know, if someone says, this guy was walking somewhere, but if you say, you know, a stooped over man suddenly stepped into the ditch, that somehow you, at least I see that more than I see the former one. So it's one of those mini principles of fiction that I think is a universal principle. But, and the thing is, there's a moral ethical aspect to it, because what I found is in workshop, the more specific you are about a story in your analysis, the less judgmental you are. So let's say, it always happens in workshops, someone will say, you know, I hated this story. It's so whatever, fill in the blank. Let's say sexist. Mm. All right. So then, now, first of all, that happens in a workshop. You're instantly in a tense zone because the person sitting there has just been accused of being a sexist or a racist or a misogynist, you know, whatever. All right. So, but what I always say is, tell me where. Just show, I don't reject your analysis, but show me where in the story you first got the idea that it was sexist. And if the person is a good reader, which our students are, they can show you. And then you see that it actually is usually a matter of specificity or accuracy. You know, if every woman in the story is stupid and all the men are brilliant, you first start noticing that trend at a certain place. If you identify it, theoretically at least, now it doesn't always happen this way, but theoretically the writer could go, oh yeah, actually I'm not a sexist. I'm just a technically deficient writer because I didn't notice that my story was so out of step with reality in that way. You know, so that's specificity. Again, it opens up into all kinds of interesting, bigger concepts.
Right. You know, now you've got me thinking about, you know, of course, if all of the nobles have inner worlds and none of the peasants do, then.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Or, you know, if you have a story in which, let's imagine whoever your political opponent is, and you have a story where those are all irremediably evil people. Part of the reader's mind balks at that because you know better. You know that whatever's going on is more complex than that. So learning to be a good reviser of your own work is kind of a way of learning to vet you know, to vet yourself. Am I coasting? Am I projecting incorrectly? And so somehow you're, the way you're tuned with respect to language is a really good way of having Hemingway called a built-in shit detector, you know? So it's very powerful, you know?
Must you be a good reader to be a good writer?
Yes, I think so. It's the same activity. And every so often I hear from somebody who says, I don't really like to read that much, but I want to write a book. I'm like, imagine if someone said, I never listen to music, but I want to be in a band. You know, I think you do. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think
there
you necessarily
are some bands
have to
like
be
that, but
yeah, there are. I don't think you have to be someone who's read everything, because I'm certainly not. You know, I think you have to have a curated sort of lineage cloud of writers that you dearly love that you go back to again and again. I don't think you have to be, you know, someone who's read every book ever written, but you have to have a fondness, because what happens is you just become aware of what tricks there are in the bag. You know, what has been done already, and how can you stand on top of what's been done already and do a little bit more? But if you don't know what's been done already, you're always kind of reinventing the wheel.
Shit, I never read Gogol until now, and I wrote my undergraduate thesis on a Confederacy of Dunces. Riddle me that one. Come on.
There's a natural connection there, isn't there? He's a Scots narrator. Yeah, yeah, right, right.
Oh, would you tell, for the benefit of our listeners, would you say what a Scots narrator is?
Yeah, well, I found this out in teaching the course. I had a colleague come in, Erica Haber from the Syracuse department. And Scots is basically just, it's a first-person narrator that sees himself as educated and clever, and he sees himself as sort of an omniscient narrator, but he's always making mistakes. So he's got kind of a too high idea of himself. He makes linguistic mistakes. He makes structural mistakes. He tries to do literary things and fails. And you might just barely notice it. In the book, I compare it to something like if you let Dwight Schrute in The Office tell you a story, you know. At first you're going, okay, it's a reliable narrator. And then certain indicators will tell you subtly that he maybe isn't to be quite trusted. And then he, in turn, becomes a character in the story. So it's a very powerful mode. And what I say in the book is basically it's the most truthful mode. Because if you stand on a bus stop, you know, and somebody starts telling a story, that's a flawed narrator, you know, even if it's you. You know, and that may, I think that adds an extra dimension of truth, especially because the person has a very distinctive voice. And, you know, we learn as much about a person by the mistakes in their mode of expression as we do from virtuosity in that realm. You know, like for me, I have a very, as I said before, really fast, too fast mind. And sometimes that makes its way into my diction and I get kind of hyperbolic and vague. Well, that's a pretty good indication of what's going on in there. So anyway, yeah. So Scots is sort of a form of particular form of unreliable narration that Gogol uses to great effect.
I honestly can't wait to dive deep into Gogol. I'm set for 2021. 2021 so far is a very hopeful year to me. How about you?
Yeah, it's okay. It's good. The story of his that I love so much is The Overcoat. And I like it more than I like The Nose, but it's harder to write about. But that's a beautiful story. And a lot of writers have said that our whole understanding of fiction kind of comes out of that story of an underdog. You know, it's an underdog who's described by one of these Scots narrators. And it's a story of great compassion that is kind of disguised as just pure humor. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful story.
I wanted to ask you, you don't consider this book to be a how-to. Do you consider it a demystification? What else?
I think I just want it to be kind of a prod, you know, I love the idea that people would read this book and either from, you know, reacting positively or even negatively to it, suddenly go, yeah, the short story, yeah, let's get after that. It's a bit of a provocation, maybe, I mean, a gentle, amiable provocation, but sort of a reminder. To me, the reminder was, okay, in my lifetime, I feel like writing and books have been somehow delegated a lower status, you know, it's almost become sort of cult-like in the sense that we all agree that nobody expects books to change the world, or we don't really expect writers to be considered in public discourse, really, you know, fiction writers. We don't, at least in my experience, we often, in our educational system, we often are privileging science and math over reading because those are a job getter, supposedly, which is actually not true. But you know what I mean? Like that, and I can't really articulate it, but this subtle idea that reading, it's nice. It's nice. That's a soft skill. We don't really need it anymore because we have coding, you know. But in fact, in fact, storytelling is what we're doing literally every instant of our lives. You know, I'm looking around my basement here where I am, and I'm telling a story about it. That's an exercise bike. This is where the cats used to go to the bathroom in the little kitty litter room. You know, those are all constructions. And so, and on a much more important scale, we tell stories politically, we tell stories romantically, ethically, everything. So the ability to work with one's own projective capabilities, storytelling capability, is so important to what makes a civilization kind, you know, or high functioning. The idea of taking joy in the stories of one's own culture, of interrogating them and saying, what do we believe in anyway? Why do we live this way? That's such a high level thing to do. And if we relegate that to hobby status or something like that, we really lose something essential. And I will go out on a very thin bit of projective ice and say, I think that's why we're in the mess we're in right now, politically, partly, is because the stories we're telling are too shrill and too brittle, and they aren't curious enough, the stories we're telling about other people. And so I think, I don't know, you know, of course, how one would get this, you know, cat back in the bag. But to me, I think about when I was educated in Chicago on the South Side, reading was almost a sacrament. You know, people really understood, and people who weren't college educated, working people, understood that if you wanted to get beyond the narrow confines of the one life you'd been given, then reading about other lives was a way to exponentially do that. You know, you could jump out of the confines of your own experience by just sitting down for an hour. And that, you know, that's a very deep skill, and we lose it at our own peril.
Oh my God. Well, I'm told there are people who eat without pleasure, for example. And now I'm forced to imagine someone who reads without pleasure, just to put a little notch on Goodreads.
Yeah. Or someone who doesn't read at all because they think it's obsolete, you know, or more sadly of all, because they haven't learned the skill. And this is a thing. One of the things I hoped with this book was that if there's somebody who has never read The Russians because they think, you know, fill in the blank, too difficult, too weird. I would love to think of myself as a gentle guide to say, you know what? These stories are not separate from your actual life. They're not separate from the things that keep you awake at night. They're not separate from the things that make you glow with pride. They're not separate from your love for your children. They were written specifically to address that part of yourself. And they're great helps in this life, you know, to feel that other people have gone before you and have really gotten deep into this experience of living. And before they passed away, they made us a little gift. You know, I think that's, it's sustenance, I think.
It's beautiful. Make you cry.
Yeah.
Have you ever imagined yourself in a bathhouse with the ghosts of these Russian masters?
Far too often. How did you know that? That's so weird that you knew that.
That was the one question that mattered to me this whole time.
Wow.
And now, if we're to analyze this conversation and go back, you know, was everything we said essential? was the payoff worth it?
We are getting to that one. Yeah, no, I definitely, you know, I do this with all the writers I admire. I think, what would he think of me, and what would he think of my stories? You know, now it's funny, as I'm getting older, it's such a, to me, a deep pleasure to be able to look at what you've done without any bloating and just go, it's okay. But you put, you know, a story of mine up against Master and Man by Tolstoy, and you're like, okay, buddy, you have a lot to learn, and you may not get there in this life. You know, that I think is kind of a lovely thing, because again, it takes you out of yourself, you know, your protective, I'm the best mind, and you go, no, I'm part of a flow of all these different writers. And, you know, we all get a little bit of talent. Some of us get more than others. The job is to do as much as you can with it. But I would like to, I'd love to spend an afternoon with Chekhov. Tolstoy too. Gogol was weird. And I don't know if there was a thing that he could supposedly, how this made its way into the record, I don't know. But he could supposedly, he had a really big nose, a long nose.
Yeah.
And he could touch the tip of his nose with his tongue and he would do it. I don't know, as a party trick or something. So I think he was a bit of an oddball, but it would be interesting, and it would probably be really sobering to see that this guy who wrote he's famous for having written two of the greatest short stories, The Overcoat and The Nose, possibly the greatest novel, Dead Souls, and one of the greatest plays, The Government Inspector, in a very short, like 12-year period. It would be sobering to meet him and find out that he was a little out of his mind, you know, or a little, whatever he was, I don't know. I didn't get the sense that he was a very likable person, but there it is, you know, he's a giant. And he looks great in a bathhouse too.
That's my man, Gogol. Oh,
that's,
my God.
Sweat just runs off that long nose. You know, it's just, I don't know.
Be still my heart. Oh, I'll tell you the question I'm not going to ask you that everybody wants me to ask you is when are we getting some more of your short stories? But I'm not going to, because I'm looking at this exchange between Gorky and Tolstoy near the end of the book. And it's like, you know, are you anxious to know? Tolstoy asked. Very, said Gorky. Then I shan't tell you, said Tolstoy.
I shan't tell you.
I shan't tell you.
I'll tell you.
Oh,
no.
Yeah, no. I'm gonna take it.
No. I was kind of working on some stories during this book, not so much. And then since it's done, I finished. There's our dog. Finished two of them, mm-hmm. and I've got two more in progress. Actually, writing this book has really helped me to be somehow more playful with my own stuff, and so I feel like there's going to be a lot more to come.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure it will help others. It helped me. And I thank you so much for the generous and playful conversation.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was George Saunders, author of A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a master class on writing, reading, and life. Out now from Random House. After the break, our editors join us with their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks in books for the week. We have young readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and editor-in-chief Tom Beer. Fiction editor Lori Muchnick is out of the office this week. So, starting with Vicki, what's your pick for us?
I have the funniest picture book I've read in a long time. It's called Ooh. Sheepish, and it's by Helen Yoon. The plot is not what you'd call super original. Let us call it evergreen. And it's about a wolf who really, 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 really wants a sheep dinner. And so the wolf goes in sheep drag to the sheep community and tries to blend in. It's got everything that a Looney Tunes cartoon would have except for a soundtrack. And I say that with that is the highest praise. But what Yoon is able to do is she adds little onomatopoeia to sort of substitute for the soundtrack. So as this wolf that's sort of swaddled in cotton wool is making its way across the fields, there's this little line of scoot, 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 running right behind the wolf. And it's just, you know, visually very, very funny. And then, of course, the wolf gets into the sheep community and looks surprisingly like a sheep, except that Yoon sort of distinguishes the wolf from the sheep by giving the wolf sort of a rectangular face and a more prominent snout. But the funniest thing is that the wolf's tail is wagging wildly in every single frame. So it's clear that although the wolf thinks that it's pretending to be a sheep with great success, the sheep understand that it is in fact a wolf. But what happens is that the wolf works so hard to ingratiate itself with the sheep that it finds itself really liking the sheep and gives up on the sheep dinner and goes home to a how to cook vegetables or how to, I think, I mean, let me go to that page. I think it's like how to love vegetables or meat is not, you know, eating meat is not okay. Cookbook. It's really funny. The no meat diet that it's just a super funny, super sweet story of interspecies friendship despite itself.
Vicki, I was so excited when you chose this book. I have to read it because, first of all, I love sheep, but also the theme around the belonging and the love and all that. It reminded me of one of my favorite picture book series. I know you're going to know what I'm going to talk about. It's the Tyrannosaurus series from Japan. They're by Tatsuya Miyanishi and translated by Mariko Shi Garbi. And like a couple of them, like, I want that love and I will love you forever. I think would be a good match for this book. You know, dinosaurs are not as cuddly as sheep, but that idea of, you know, who fits in and why, and, you know, tapping into our better natures, it's just a natural fit for this one, I think.
Absolutely. I love that series also, Laura, and thank you for bringing it up. I think they do make a great pairing.
Vicky's pick for the week is called Sheepish. It's by Helen Yoon. Thank you, Vicky, for that choice. Laura, you're up next. What's your book of the week?
So my book this week is Concrete Rose by Angie Thomas. And I have to say, I was so nervous before I started reading this book because, of course, you know, The Hate U Give, it came out in 2017. It was her debut that was just, you know, so iconic. It made such a big impact at the time. And since, it's still a bestseller. People are still talking about it. It's still relevant in so many ways, unfortunately. So reading a prequel that, you know, the same characters and, you know, set in Garden Heights, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, will she be able to live up to The Hate U Give? And I have to say, I think she topped it. It's just surpassed my expectations in so many ways. So readers get to return to Garden Heights when Maverick and Lisa, Star's parents, were 17, you know, the age Star was in The Hate U Give. And you get to know them as teenagers themselves. So it's kind of like this, you know, back in time. It's Lisa, you know, college bound and academic and ambitious. Maverick's kind of trying to figure out his role in the neighborhood and his family, his relationship. You know, his father's in prison. He's not sure how much to get involved with the King Lords. Everything kind of goes pear-shaped when he finds out that his best friend King's sort of on-again, off-again girlfriend, Aisha, gave birth to his baby. So Seven, the baby who grows up to be Seven, is actually his and not King's. And then Lisa ends up pregnant, you know, with Star. It's like everything is sort of imploding. And there's just so much depth to it. It's just beautifully executed. And I was thinking, you know, as teenagers, you often don't really understand your parents, or you think your parents can't possibly understand you. And so this opportunity to sort of see like your parents or Star's parents, who you got to know as adults, to see them when they were your age is just this really fascinating experiment. And she pulls it off so well. I can't recommend it highly enough.
That's so good to hear, Laura, because two of the YA books that I've read recently were her other two books. Haven't read much in the past few years, but I loved Hate U Give and On the Come Up. So I know I'll love this one as well. You think we're going to get a continuation of this story?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure fans will clamor for
I'm
more,
sure.
But I don't know. She's after The Hate U Give, she said, that's it. But we
can we give like some love to the designer of the covers too? I love the continuity across the three. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's been mentioned, but they're great.
Now, striking cover art definitely makes an impact. Actually, the first time The Hate U Give really struck me was I remember seeing the cover on the, you know, the banners, and it's just like across the room. It was so striking.
Yeah.
Okay, Laura. So how was your interview with Angie?
Oh, that was great too. So yes, look for the feature on the website. I don't know if it will be up at the time the podcast goes out, but...
But what is up? And something I have to confess to you that I haven't mentioned before. I love it when you do an interview and you put a screen grab from the author. It always looks like you two are having so much fun, like 2-1. I love seeing those images.
Oh, thank you. And we do have fun. And it was great talking to her. It was such a treat.
The title of the book, one more time, is Concrete Rose. And the author is, of course, Angie Thomas. Laura, thank you very much for this pick. Next, we've got nonfiction. Eric, what have you chosen for us?
I've chosen a memoir called Being Ram Dass by Ram Dass, who was born Richard Alpert. But he, you know, is one of the main seekers in the hallucinogenic research with LSD in the 60s and 70s. And then he kind of continued his journey through enlightenment and spirituality in India, where he became a disciple of a major Hindu guru there. And he kind of learned how to worship without using drugs. And it's just a really good, anybody who's interested in that time period, which is me, you know, there's Allen Ginsberg, Aldous Huxley, Ken Kesey, The Grateful Dead. He really covers that that gives a new perspective on that kind of, you know, Haight-Ashbury type history. And it's also just a really good, for anybody who likes spiritual memoirs, it's really enlightening and it's not heavy-handed in any way. So he's a pretty steady guide to his life. You know, he died last year, but I'm happy that we have this record of his life. And I know that Vicky has a story that I really want to hear about.
Well, it's my husband's story, really. Yeah, he told me when we heard about Ram Dass's passing, and I'm guessing it's not in the biography, but as my husband describes it, he was at what he calls some hippie thing in Vermont and was, you know, making his way through the groves and came across Ram Dass and a little circle of acolytes. And what he remembers is really striking, which is that Ram Dass was wearing this incredible and what my husband imagines was a fabulously expensive Irish knit sweater. And he was just sitting there nodding sagely saying, "It's always too much. It's never enough. It's always too much. It's never enough."
Yes. That's perfect. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's the tagline for this podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good story, man. Thank you. Thank you for that one. That is amazing. And this is an amazing pick from Eric. Thank you for it. Being Ram Dass by Ram Dass. I will be picking this one up. Last, but certainly not least, we have Tom's pick. And this is always the wild card. So, Tom, you know, what's the flavor of your recommendation this week?
The flavor, Megan, is fiction. And I think it's maybe the first 2021 book that I read last year, and it's probably my favorite 2021 book so far. It's a novel called Detransition Baby by a first-time novelist named Tori Peters, and I love this book so much. Tori Peters is a trans writer. She had written a couple of novellas that she gave away for free on her website, and then she got a big book deal to do this novel. And it's about three characters. Reese is a trans woman in New York in her 30s who kind of dates married men and you know, kind of gets herself into trouble. She's got a great sense of humor and an attitude, but she wants more out of her life. The second character is her ex-girlfriend, who at the time was Amy, who was also a trans woman, but has decided to detransition and is now living as Ames, stopped taking hormones, presenting as a man, and is very confused and unhappy. You know, basically couldn't handle life as a trans woman, found it too hard, and decided to go back to living as a man. And then the third character is Katrina, who is Ames's boss, who begins an office affair with Ames. And Ames, who thought he would not be able to get a woman pregnant anymore, had been told that by the doctors. In fact, it gets Katrina pregnant. And so these three characters who are all linked by this baby, and Reese realizes the one thing that she's always wanted is to be a mother. And so they start to very cautiously and ambivalently circle each other and figure out, can they form some sort of strange family around this child that's coming? So it's a really unusual story, but it's so smartly written. It's funny. It's got a lot of depth to it. And I think it's just terrific. I think it would be a great book club book, to be honest, because it just would get people talking and thinking in a really terrific way.
You know, I thought it would be a really great fully booked podcast book, but alas, I looked at the print schedule and there it was, Editor-in-Chief Tom Beers interviewing Tori Peters about Detransition Baby. And you know what that means?
I preempted you.
Well, but I'm happy for you, and I can't wait. I still don't have a copy yet, but I can't wait to buy this book and get my hands on it and get into it. And you've made it sound even more appealing. You have really fanned the flames. So thank you for that, Tom.
Yeah, it's a terrific book. You'll love it.
One more time for the people in the back. It is Detransition Baby by Tori Peters. Thanks again, Tom. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. Please join us again next week when my guest will be writer, essayist, and teacher Matthew Salices. He's the author of a new book called Craft in the Real World. Very excited to dig into that. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.